We're ready to begin our next session, and the format of this session is that we have three esteemed guests who will be members of our panel, who will each speak for about 5 or 10 minutes about the question of the legacy of the Yale School and it's the future of contemporary state of theology and the future of theology in light of the contribution of the Yale School. And so, just to introduce them briefly, we have first, on my left over here, Fritz Bauerschmidt, who is a professor of theology. Sorry, I want to make sure I get it. Associate professor of theology at the Department of...
Professor.
Oh, yeah. Full professor of theology. Yeah. Right, okay. At the Department of Theology at Loyola College, Maryland. Fritz has recently come out with a book called Thomas Aquinas, Faith, Reason, and Following Christ from Oxford University Press. It's an extremely dense, thoughtful, and really profound portrayal of Aquinas' theology, which is highly recommendable to everyone. He has a book that's known to many of us who've taught undergraduates called Holy Teaching, Introducing the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas, which is the best kind of book to give someone who's uninitiated to Aquinas to kind of get an explanation of the vocabulary and a way of reading Aquinas, etc., with his own translations. He's got a number of other books and many articles. He went to Yale Law, Divinity School in 1989. He completed his master's there before he went on to write his doctorate under Stanley Hauerwas, who is himself, of course, deeply influenced by the Limbeck-Fry Project, which he did at Duke Divinity School. Our second speaker will be Gary Culpepper. Gary is well known to all of us here because he, originally studied his doctorate at CUA across the street. On Pannenberg and Aquinas on God and Christ, so already with a very strong dialogical bent of engagement of Thomistic themes in conversation with modern theological themes. He was at the time also an assistant editor under then Father Augustine de Noia at the Thomist, so he engaged in a great number of ecumenical conversations and contemporary theological disputes as an editor and early on as a young theologian. He's been teaching for many years at Providence College and so lives on the front lines and in the trenches in trying to understand how to convey the significance of doctrine to a contemporary academic audience of young people. And he was a great help to me when I was at Providence and was trying to figure out how to do the same thing and was often having conversations with him about strategy. He's also been engaged in a number of ecumenical projects and has written frequently on questions of divine attributes. And finally, we have Professor Chad Pecknold, who has his PhD originally from the University of Cambridge, where he wrote with David Ford and published his doctorate as a book called Transforming Post-Liberal Theology from T.N.T. Clark in 2005. He has since then written a great deal on Augustine and also on Aquinas, and is self-described as an Augustinian Thomist. He has the dubious privilege of co-editing a new series at the Catholic University of America Press called the Sacra Doctrina series on the renewal of theology with a somewhat pugnacious and benighted Thomist. And so I will be watching to see if he says the right things about the future of theology. Anyway, so we're very happy to have all three of them, and we're going to go in alphabetical order, and so I invite Fritz to make some comments.
Thanks. I never set out to be post-liberal. I was just a guy who had read a lot of Wittgenstein as an undergraduate and then discovered through a book review sometime in the mid-80s that this person at Yale named George Lindbeck had used Wittgenstein in doing theology, and so I decided that was the place for me to go and ended up taking Lindbeck's course on Thomas Aquinas and also a course he did on Karl Rahner and Hans Urs von Balthasar. And so, but then Father TJ will be glad to know, I decided I would go south for my doctorate. Now, reading St. Thomas over the years, it leads to a habit of mind in which one tends, as an opening gambit, to make distinctions. And so, really, my remarks in terms of post-liberal theology and Thomism going forward is really to offer a map. And I offer this map with the caveat that Professor Root reminded us of yesterday, that the map is not the territory, but it's better than not having a map. So I want to offer a couple of distinctions. First, between what I would call political post-liberalism and theological post-liberalism, and second, between post-liberalism and anti-liberalism. My hope is that these distinctions will prove useful as we think about the future of post-liberal theology and the contribution that St. Thomas might make to that. So with regard to my first distinction, let me issue a preemptive disclaimer that I don't want to place politics and theology in separate bins. I take it for granted that there is no purely secular political theory or practice, no way of ordering common life that does not have some sort of metaphysical investment, does not make some claim, maybe unarticulated, about the good for human beings in general. And I likewise take it for granted that there's no apolitical theology, no language by which we speak about our final end that does not presume a common life that carries that language. And simply in issuing this disclaimer, I suppose that I have revealed myself to be post-liberal in both the political and theological senses. But despite this disclaimer and its consequent self-revelation, I do think that the distinction between these two sorts of post-liberalism is a useful one for analytic purposes. Now, one way to think about this distinction is genetically. Of course, a genealogy of either sort of post-liberalism will be tendentious and endlessly contestable, but I'm not going to let that stop me. We might, therefore, locate the origins of what I'm calling political post-liberalism in something like Alistair MacIntyre's recovery of the notion of tradition and the unmasking of liberalism as no less of a tradition than any of a variety of other traditions of inquiry into the good life. We might locate the origins of theological post-liberalism in, as Professor Root, I think, pointed out, Karl Barth's revolt against liberal Protestantism of his teachers, and the way in which Barth's theology was interpreted and mediated by the Yale School, by which I really mean George Lindbeck and Hans Frey. Now, some, particularly Catholics, might want to trace their post-liberalism back to a more Catholic-friendly figure like Luther. Newman. I'm thinking about Professor Root here. Newman. Boy, that's like a Freudian. I actually consider Calvin more Catholic-friendly than Luther. So, a more Catholic-friendly figure like Newman, and in support of such an origin, I would note that the one class that I had the good fortune to take with Hans Frey immediately before his death, in that class he suggested that it was perhaps Newman, with his focus on the church and tradition, rather than the German obsession with the veracity of Scripture, who got the issue right in the 19th century. Anyway, however we locate the precise origins of these post-liberalisms, it seems to me that these two streams are distinct, in part because both streams, the MacIntyrean political post-liberalism and the Yale School theological post-liberalism, have flowed together into the immensely influential work of my teacher, Stanley Hauerwas. People tend to think that they come as a package deal. But it seems to me entirely possible to embrace one and not the other. Of course, political and theological post-liberalism share common features, formal features, in particular an emphasis on the linguistic and therefore tradition-constituted nature of reason, along with a critique of emotivist and or expressivist accounts of moral or religious doctrines. Yet, as St. Thomas tells us, whereas sacred doctrine is primarily a matter of speculative reasoning, politics is a matter of practical reasoning, which suggests that we cannot simply identify the theological and the political. In speculative matters, which concern necessary things, there is certainty concerning both principles and conclusions. conclusions of matters of detail. But in, as Thomas says, in matters of action, truth or practical rectitude is not the same for all as to matters of detail, but only as to general principles. So the point is, because our manner of reasoning in matters theological differs from our manner of reasoning in matters political, it's entirely possible to be convinced that something beyond liberalism is the way to go in theology, but not in politics, and vice versa. And I think this is one place where Thomas can be helpful. I take it to be fairly obvious that one might reject liberalism as a political philosophy while remaining committed to some sort of liberal expressivist account of religion. And Peter Berger springs to mind as a kind of clear example of this. Perhaps more controversially, one might be a theological post-liberal who sees the church as a tradition and a community that stands over and against the secular liberal state, while still maintaining that the kind of political arrangements fostered by liberal democracies, particularly guarantees of religious liberty and other rights, and a structure of living together that does not depend on agreement on ultimate ends, are perhaps the best chance for preserving the church from entanglements that compromise the gospel. Now, I'm not sure if I believe that. It kind of depends on the day of the week you ask me. But it does not seem to me to be an incoherent position. So that's the first distinction. Here's the second distinction between post-liberalism and anti-liberalism. I would say that whereas anti-liberalism rejects liberalism, whether in politics or theology, as a noxious ideology that the world would have been better off without, and I guess radical orthodoxy springs to mind as a form of anti-liberalism, post-liberalism to one degree or another builds on the liberal project, or at least seeks to appropriate what is useful in the liberal inheritance while moving beyond forms of liberalism that are limited, wrongheaded, or even corrosive. So, for example, I would say that certain magisterial documents of the later 19th and early 20th century operate out of an anti-liberal perspective, seeing both political and theological liberalism as a drastic wrong turn for humanity that must be resisted in toto, whereas the documents of the Second Vatican Council are post-liberal, in the sense that they take up such liberal values as religious freedom or the historical critical reading of scripture and redeploy them within an intellectual framework that avoids the individualism and rationalism to which liberalism so often falls prey. One might question how successful such a redeployment is, both with regard to post-liberalism in general and the documents of Vatican II in particular, but it seems to me there is a clear difference from anti-liberalism. Now, I want to further suggest with regard to St. Thomas that I think his use of Aristotle gives us a model of how one can engage in a piecemeal, ad hoc redeployment of elements of a worldview that one judges to be ultimately inadequate. In a sense, in Thomas's way of being post-Aristotelian, he suggests how we might be post-liberal. Neither a full embrace of liberalism nor an anti-liberal rejection of the liberal worldview in toto, but rather a critical appropriation of elements of liberalism that is normed by the gospel and the tradition of the church. Just as such Aristotelian elements as the notion of the unicity of substantial form or virtue as a habitus proved and continue to prove useful to the church, so too such things as the language of human rights or freedom of conscience might, and I emphasize might, prove similarly useful to the church today. Yet, while Thomas provides us a model for the post-liberal project, we ought also to recognize our differences from him. In particular, post-liberalism has a self-consciousness about language and culture as the matrix within which we act and think that one honestly just does not find in St. Thomas. Thomas does show a salutary attention to language and pursues theological inquiry within the context of the embodied tradition of the church. you can see this in, for example, the article where he meticulously analyzes the proposition, the body of Christ is made out of bread. But we don't find in him such post-liberal notions as the tradition-constituted nature of rationality or a cultural linguistic theory of doctrine, which is perhaps simply to say that we lie on the other side of liberalism from Thomas. And this means that we will necessarily approach matters somewhat differently, being more attentive to things that Thomas took for granted, responding to challenges Thomas never knew. I suppose it's sort of like fish are not going to be real informative to you about water because they're immersed in it. And it's only now that we have been pulled out of tradition, right, that suddenly we become attentive to it as something we must somehow restore. And that's just not Thomas's problem, right? That's our problem. But this shouldn't disturb us, since Thomas himself knew that when attempting to hand on the received truth we have contemplated, we might in fact have to say something new. Thanks.
I just jump up there.
You do? Okay. Not literally.
Good afternoon. I did not study at Yale. I arrived at CUA across the street in 1986, coming with an interest in Ignatian exercises and a continuation of my study of Karl Rahner. David Tracy's work seemed basic to our overall approach across the street. Analogical Imagination was published in 1981. As we know, George Lindbeck's Nature Doctrine published in 1984. The students across the street were, when I arrived, right, were still very much engaged in the Yale-Chicago debate. Father Dulles had been critical of David Tracy's work. I studied, in the beginning of my career, I studied under David Dulles. And he raised a particular issue in class one day. This was the question of whether faith is required for the work of theology, or should we understand academic theology as a discipline like other academic disciplines. On that day, Dulles enabled me to see for the first time beyond the categories of liberal and conservative theology, which I've been inclined to think in terms of, what Aquinas meant by the formal object of theological study. I had begun to see that reflection upon the ecstatic self-transcendent movement of spirit as the actualization of human personality and community in Christ could be a form of thinking outside the lumen of faith. It just dawned on me for the first time that such a thing was possible. I like the metaphor coming across the street, so I'll use it again. In 1989, I came across the street, this time moving north to south, and I met Father DeNoia. We called him Father DeNoia in those days. Here was a real member of the Yale School, and I'll never forget his conviction that the theologian must swallow it whole. Do you remember saying that? Yeah, of course you do. Yeah. The theologian must swallow it whole. I suspect that in speculative and practical matters, you swallow it whole. Despite my initial conversion under Father Dulles, Father DeNoia struck me as someone bent on reviving fideism. This was too much for me. Swallow it whole. It was clear that Father DeNoia, no, it was clear to me, right, that he did not ground his theological thinking in the transcendental conditions for the possibility of knowledge of God. Okay, that's good. But he took it too far. Unlike St. Thomas, Father DeNoia did not ground his theological reflection and demonstration of the existence of God. Aquinas teaches very clearly in Summa Contra Gentiles 1.9. Now, among the inquiries that we must undertake concerning God in himself, we must set down in the beginning that whereby his existence is demonstrated as the necessary foundation of the whole work. For if we do not demonstrate that God exists, all consideration of divine things is necessarily suppressed. Father DeNoia was a fideist. Now, he taught us. I bracketed that for a moment. And I listened. Father DeNoia taught us to read scripture. I'm sorry, to read the Summa. There's one of those Freudian slips. To read the Summa as a narrative. Now, here I'll mix some memory with my own later development of what I learned from Father DeNoia. The Summa is a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's told in three parts. It begins in medias res. Now, I was tempted to say, like all great epics, it begins in medias res. But that would be to subsume the scriptures under a more comprehensive genre. And Father DeNoia taught us that this is something a Christian theologian would never want to do. The story begins in ST 1.2.3. The Lord says, I am. The holy name announced here summons worship. And at this point, today, teaching my students using Fritz's book, after a brief lesson on Hashem and the Tetragrammaton, I asked the students in my class to meditate on this name, the sacred name that is pronounced at the beginning of the story called the Summa. Now, all the students, I mean, at PC, well, yoga, right, is the rage where I teach. Okay? So I help them understand that what we're going to do is what Aquinas called contemplare. And we're going to contemplate the divine name spoken at the beginning of this story. Now, I borrow from the exercises. I remember I came to CUA with an interest in the exercises. And in 1.1.8, odd 2, Aquinas teaches, hence the apostle says, bringing into captivity every understanding under the obedience of Christ, I take this as a legitimate exercise. That's a little tongue-in-cheek. I ask students, as they're contemplating, if they've discerned any identifying traits of this God in their contemplation. They report being perplexed. The text begins to question us. What does the earlier discussion of contemplation on that than which nothing greater can be thought, discussed in 1.1.1, what does this have to do with the revelation of the divine name and the contemplation of this name? So we turn to the biblical narrative for clues. Why is this name associated with a burning bush in the desert? What is the meaning of the promise to rescue Moses and his people from their anguish associated with this event? And who is Moses anyway? This was the method I learned from Father DeNoia, who would say that fidelity to the narrative logic and allowing the text to surprise and question us, to engender argument about its meaning, along with the contemplation described above, is integral to theological method. Now, what about the proofs for the existence of God, presented in connection with the speaking of the divine name? I think post-liberal theology, at least post-liberal Thomism, has made its greatest contribution and cleared the way for us precisely here. Most of us just assume this, I would think, what I'm about to say. But it could not always be assumed. Earnest readers of St. Thomas in the modern period, foundationalists like Rahner, the radical apophatics who are with us today, and even those attempting to recover the literal sense of Aquinas' text, erred, right, in this understanding of the relationship between the proof for the existence of God, right, in the hearing of the divine name. To take this a step further, right, in reading, right, 1, 2, 3. For the post-liberal, the first via, the way of motion, gives insight into the Lord who moves all things. The mind, like an owl in the daylight, needs assistance to see the God announced under the radiance of this name. The process begins, as Thomas is wont to say, with the more known moving us into the less known, or incomprehensible. A first cause is not first in a series of causes, but is the cause of the series, which in turn is not part of the series, and is in no way defective because it is not part of the series. Okay? That's what we learn by borrowing, right, from these demonstrations, right? Our mind begins there and is on its way to getting an array of insight into the divine name. The starting point developed further, this starting point, right, about motion and the ultimate mover will illuminate every action of God in the rest of the story. It's another thing Father Benoit has taught us, right, that this story has characters or agents, and we want to attempt to understand the agency of God, the agent. So this initial insight enables us to understand the divine action in the rest of the story. It gives rise to thinking about creation ex nihilo and the offer of divine favor or assistance in its many different forms is illuminated, right, by precisely this understanding of, mostly negative, understanding of divine causality. It prepares for the insight into the identity of this God as capable of the greatest miracle. And it's a miracle that does not even violate the laws of nature. This is the miracle of delivering humans in their freedom from sin, death, and the devil. This identity is disclosed, right? You have to be patient. This identity is disclosed in the third part when it is announced that the I Am enters into human history in the flesh. But you could imagine, right, how you would continue to read the Summa, and I won't go into that here. Post-liberal theology, and post-liberal Thomism in particular, its deepest insights, right, if we can abstract for a moment from the particularity of the name, right, the unsayable name, the most particular name for Aquinas, if we abstract just a bit and speak of truth, goodness, and beauty, the deepest insights into truth, goodness, and beauty are received in the light of faith, when the theological game is played according to the doctrinal rules. If you play outside the rules, the delight that comes from theological study is sacrificed for a happiness that is infinitely less than what is promised by God in the narrative. These are the kinds of things I learned from Father Denoya. I have a full range of questions, not unlike Jim Buckley or others during the conference, and there's no need for me here to just pile on and add a larger range, right, of questions for post-liberal Thomism today. But I'd like to bring forward two that build on some questions that have already been raised. And the first is this. If according to post-liberal Thomism, true knowledge of God is discovered within and not outside the narrative, that is, through faith, right, or credere Deo, what role, if any, does the natural knowledge of God, right, taught in Romans 1, 19, 20, what role do the preambula fidei, what role does implicit faith, right, play in post-liberal Thomism? These are all the conventional, right, questions that I think are posed today. Now, with attention to implicit faith, Father Denoya treats implicit faith and diversity of religions as a long time ago, but he's still thinking about these things, and we're thinking about these things. When I speak about implicit faith, what I mean here is a faith that posits true knowledge of God outside of contact with the biblical narrative, but not outside knowledge of Christ. That's the way I read Aquinas in his treatment on faith, especially question 2, article 7 and 8. I have another question, but I think that's enough for now. So thank you, Father Denoya. Thank you.
it like when I was a kid and we'd get together with the family and we'd watch these slideshows, multi-generation slideshows, and I was a little kid watching all the big kids over the years. You wondered what went before you, what comes after. It's a little bit of that with all these post-liberals who I once looked up to and now don't. No, I'm just kidding. Fry's Barthian emphasis on radical particularity and narrated identity of Jesus Christ was a welcome disruption from the liberal Protestant attempt at universal religious sentiment that I saw all around me in Seattle, in a secular context, where I had at 18 years old an evangelical conversion in which I thought I should read up about this evangelical stuff, and so I went to the bookstore and I found Karl Barth's Evangelical Theology and bought it to read. I also found Vernon Bork's Essential Augustine. And so Bork's Essential Augustine and Karl Barth's Evangelical Theology happened to me as a new Christian. Soon I'd learn about the burgeoning Yale School in my undergraduate theology classes in 1990. At the time, I found the Yale School both terrifying, worried from the beginning about relativism, and gripping. I kept returning to the thought which had become associated with an institution so tied up with early American evangelicals and with our contemporary culture despisers, Yale University. It promised respectability for evangelical claims. I wanted that. Both Fry and Lindbeck were interested in getting the right kind of angle on comparative religion and comparative theology to put the universal religious sentiment into doubt, I think, and to return to the particularity of traditions in the way that Fritz already talked about McIntyre, the particularity of practices studied in context of Christian belief that was internally consistent. Fry's emphasis on viewing Christianity as, quote, a semiotically coherent cultural system, as he puts it in his proposal for the types of Christian theology, was of a piece with Lindbeck's cultural linguistic approach, each committed to a coherentist understanding which would not rely on a universalizing account of religious experience nor a set of propositional claims which could be rationally assessed apart from a lived form of the narrative which said propositions from which said propositions derived. There's not a little Barthianism in such proposals, though at least one Emersonian philosopher of religion, Jeffrey Stout, thought Fry best understood in terms of Anselmian theology, working out the internal consistency of Christian claims, perhaps. Lindbeck is more complicated. Having written on Duns Scotus on the concept of being and debates about essentialism, engaging Gilson's reading of the great Franciscan thinker, and then the providential break of his becoming the Lutheran Observer, a Lutheran Observer at Vatican II, were the breakpoints. His contributions are more clearly bound up with the Catholic Church than Fry's, and touch on Thomism and post-liberalism more directly, and so I will speak more to Lindbeck. It's with Lindbeck also that I wrestled most. It's him who influenced me the most. I wanted to believe, with Bruce Marshall, that his thought was moderately realist and analytically Thomist rather than inclining towards anomalism, a charge which was sometimes leveled at him. Thomas Joseph White's concern yesterday that this may haunt the Yale School is not at all misplaced, I think, even if the worry can be mitigated, cautioned against, and maybe rightly so. I note especially that the Church's primary mode of pre-theological endeavor, for most of its history, has worked within the category of being. It is always attended from Augustine's work on the sign thing relation to Aquinas's triplex via on analogical predication as well, this secondary, perhaps tandem interest in fundamental concerns about realistic reference and about modes of signifying the signified thing are prominent. But Lindbeck's pre-theological, account prescinds from the category of being altogether, rather arguing along coherentist lines that it's the internally coherent account which has correspondential reference, whereas individual propositions remain always revisable. There clearly are ways to understand this as a kind of moderate realism. I don't mean to suggest that there aren't. At least it's not hard to imagine how they could be argued such. That Yale avoided any pre-theological account, however, that worked along traditional lines is perhaps understandable in context, but maybe absolutely not a recommendation for how to proceed along the lines of preambula fidei. Yale's pre-theological methodology worked in the category, to borrow a phrase, of relation. Cultural linguistic signification, rule following, and the need for stable structures for determining the nature of doctrines in a tradition and comparatively across traditions is the most significant contribution that Yale, I think, made. There's something, perhaps Anselmian here, about the beauty of logic and about determining the ordered harmony of the whole. But it must be said that it sent more students off to read Wittgenstein and Geertz than it sent them off to read those classic Christian sources, which made different pre-theological arguments. My own attempt to emphasize Augustine's ontological priority of things in the light of God in his study of the sign-thing relations in De Doctrina Christiana was my small way of registering a worry that I had that Yale was a semiotic corner out of which one had to argue oneself if you were to gain credibility as a theologian in the modern, quite liberal guild of theology. What I have thought most about since my conversion to the Catholic faith in 2006 is how the Yale School actually built a bridge for me to the Catholic Church. And so I want to talk a little bit about how, not only how I'm still a little critical, but how I'm grateful. Lindbeck himself was against individual conversions. I don't know, but I imagine he would prefer things like the Anglican Ordinariate, wherein whole historic Christian communities, once separated from communion with Peter, would return. I would like to think he favored, with long-suffering patience and in God's good providence, an ecumenism of return, but shorn of all individual triumphalism. This is partly why it's so amazing and even mysterious to me that so many of the students of Yale, and if I can put it this way, the grand students, myself, have taken that short swim, or maybe long swim, across the Tiber. It's somewhat like how I think about the conversions that occurred around Wittgenstein himself. What good things God can bring out of nominalism. Another amazing aspect to not a few post-liberal converts to Catholicism and observers of them is an interest in Aquinas in the main, the reasons for which we've already heard, and also a burgeoning side interest, or a burgeoning main interest for some of us, in thinkers like Cardinal Newman and Matthias Schaben. The importance of Schaben in particular has been interesting to me, his import for the ever-lively debates over nature and grace, for example, or about the renewal of dogmatic theology. A Schabenian turn is partly thanks to Bruce Marshall, who, when I had had my fill of Henri de Lubac as a relatively new convert, he kindly directed me to read Schaben, in this room, in fact. And Schaben was indeed a tonic. Schaben's attraction among post-liberal converts, at least a few of us, has, I think, more going for it, however, than simply the strong recommendation of Professor Marshall. It gets to Mike Root's suggestion that Yale is part of a much longer conversation about 19th century mediating theologies, and what is there to be mediated in the light of the one true mediator. As Aidan Nichols notes in his published notes on Schaben's thought, published as Romance and System in 2010, you could say Schaben unites what Lindbeck would call the cognitive propositional of the Roman school, pedagogically Thomistic at heart, to the rhetorically and sometimes substantially romantic trends of the Tübingen school, in a way which plunges the reader not into endless hermeneutical and methodological disputes, but plunges the reader rather into the coherence of theological claims across several schools of a single capital T tradition. It seems fitting, of course, also to Bruce Marshall's claims about working out conflicts between doctrinal claims that one would turn to Chabon, since he doesn't belong to any single school. And thus perhaps shows us where Yale School should go. It seems, I think, quite clear, at least to me, that Lindbeck was always more sympathetic to the cognitive propositionalists, to why I might favor Garrigou, for example. It's why post-liberal Catholics tend not to have allergies, I think, to Garrigou-Lagrange that so many of our cradle Catholic colleagues do, not thinking of anyone in particular. But Lindbeck also wanted to form a single coherent approach which combined aspects of the propositionalist and an attentiveness to experience, especially through attention to language, within the right form, a whole lived reality. That sounds very much like what Chabon aims at least in his Mysteries of Christianity, and also in his other works. I think a symmetry is there, a kind of continuity with difference, a symmetry with that maybe is even providential, a way in which and one could make similar claims, I think, with Newman, that Newman and Chabon have been bridges. Lindbeck first, I think, encounters all of these tensions in the Catholic world through Gilson, and he sees their counterparts in the Lutheran and broader Protestant world. Lindbeck is and was tapping into precisely the tensions he saw at Vatican II as an observer, and the ambiguities of his thought, I think, aren't too terribly removed from the ambiguities present at the Council itself and the implementation of it. These, as well as the conflicts. These are some of the reasons why I think Lindbeck actually is useful and continues to be useful as a bridge for Protestants to enter into the Catholic Church's thinking, and also a bridge for Catholics to engage with Protestants in genuine ecumenical dialogue, which remains important. It's also why I think the Yale School is better off being transformed, or better, being received in some, or at least many, if not all, of its one-time adherents. We are now free to return, I think, to dogmatic theology without hermeneutical reserve, or even without metaphysical reserve. This bridge that was built, I think, is in no small part also to friendship. And one of the things I've observed as one of the grandchildren, as it were, is how important friendship has been to the Yale School. friendship and prayer. One of the things that strikes me so much is how the friendships go on and on and are rooted in the life of the church and in the prayers of the church. And I can't help but think that Yale has been a fruitful bridge into the Catholic Church precisely because of the prayers of Archbishop Denoyer, of the Dominicans who have hosted so many of the conversations, and who I think whose friendship and prayer has opened doors, frankly, for many, many people to come into the Church by God's grace. And this is what I think is most beautiful about Archbishop Denoyer's contribution to the Yale School. So thank you very much.
So since there's three speakers, and what I'll do is I'll referee the questions, and I should just make a note that we have midday prayer at 12, and so we will not finish by then. But if the brothers who wish to go should just know that they should feel free to get up and leave, and we will count them as fulfilling a very holy and divine obligation, not as people seeking out of the conference. So
But let me, I'll take questions, moderate questions for a few, for maybe 20 minutes or so. And then we'll allow Quizlet. You might specify who your question is to, or you might specify that you'd like all three of the speakers to respond.
This is Fritz, actually. I'm intrigued by the analogy between post-liberalism and post-Aristotelianism with Aquinas. I've used that myself, you know, with Confucianism before, as you know, in the conversation. But I was just wondering if you could articulate something, maybe the other side of the analogy, of what might be different between the project Thomas has in moving past Aristotle and what challenges are for the post-liberal taking away from the liberal project what's good and shifting that.
That's an interesting question. I guess I would say that certainly Aristotle and liberalism pose quite distinct challenges to Christianity, right? And in particular, I do think what liberalism does is it's like pulling the fish out of the water, right? It pulls people out of traditions, and I think if McIntyre is right, and I'm inclined to think he is, it pulls them actually into a different tradition, the tradition of liberalism, but it's a self-consciously thin tradition. So I think it can live. It introduces human beings into a maybe an unprecedented mode of existence, or a mode of existence that only in past history has existed after great disasters that have destroyed civilizations, and we've now just made this our mode of operation, right? And it's kind of only the thinnest remnants of tradition, but still something like a tradition. But I think, and I don't know, maybe this is partly in response to Chad's remarks, but I think the attentiveness to language and culture is a kind of an ad hoc response to the exigencies of liberalism, right? A need to re-emphasize those. Now, my sense is, Chad, that you're saying, well, but what also needs to be emphasized is metaphysics, because that's the other thing that seems to get thrown out, or again, a very thin metaphysics in liberalism. And that's possibly the case, and that might just be what, Lindbeck, in particular, maybe just saw a different challenge. You know, he was addressing one part of the challenge and not another. And so I think that that's something different from what Thomas was facing with Aristotle, right? Aristotle somewhat disembedded theology from its previous, you know, in quotation marks, Augustinian tradition. But I don't think it wasn't a cultural phenomenon in which people had suddenly become rootless, right? And or at least were made to feel very self-conscious about their roots, right? That being rooted suddenly made you strange, right? And so that's why I think post-liberalism reflects so much on language and culture, and both in its political and theological form. In a way that Thomas, he's like a fish in the water. He doesn't, he's not attentive to that. So,
could I just add that? I mean, just briefly, I agree completely with Fritz's use of this idea of the fish in the water. But in the very opening article of the methodological portion, Aquinas shows his profound awareness of cultural linguistic things when he distinguishes, right, the two kinds of theological sciences. So he's reading his Bible, praying with his Dominican brothers, as I've been doing here the last day or so, and there it is right there. But he's not reflecting on it, over against, another culture and tradition.
Right. And I might add, just connecting with Mike Root's remarks about the Yale school versus post-liberalism, I actually think the best way to read that opening article is actually about a debate between two literal schools, mm-hmm. right? The arts faculty and the theology faculty. And people in the arts faculty who are saying, why do we need a theology faculty?
Why do we need this other school? And I think rather than see it as a debate between two abstractions called philosophy and theology, I think there's real value. It's not everything you need to say about it, but there's real value in reading that article as a dispute between embodied modes of inquiry that Thomas is intimately familiar with.
These were all three very interesting. Prince, next to your name, I wrote politics. Next to Gary's name, I wrote apologetics. Better word. And next to Chad, I wrote Catholics. Three different, very important.
Well, how about Chad's link?
Let's be together.
Yeah, I mean, there's questions about each of these. I mean, on the apologetics question, I mean, you know, surprise, famous phrase. All apologetics is eyeball.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, is that true? Can a Catholic maintain that all apologetics is eyeball? Maybe to Fritz, I wonder, like, the anti-liberalism that you talk about. I mean, and this is actually, it seems to me, an important issue in American culture today and tomorrow. I mean, the sort of dogmatics of politics, and how is it that Catholics, ordinary Catholics in communities, but also politicians who have to deal with these issues. I mean, we've got anti-liberal Catholics all over the place, and we've got liberal Catholics all over the place. I mean, how should that conversation go? And I'll have to think more to get a question for you, Chad, but I will. But those two questions, maybe.
Yeah, I do, actually. Thank you so much. I did want to take that question just a little bit further and just let you know what's in my mind. This is where I would start. It's not so much apologetics, but I'm thinking in my own immediate context, we have seminarians who come to study in our philosophy department. I was also speaking to a young friar this morning. Is there any such thing as a proper philosophical formation of the Catholic mind? That's the way I'm... So it's not apologetics, but I'm thinking about it from that point of view primarily. Whether it's the mind of the seminarian or the lay Catholic and that sort of thing. And then I'd like to connect this to our question earlier about soul. If we're speaking about the human soul, we're speaking about mind, created mind, and we're speaking about a created mind that operates, right, traditional scholasticism, with the powers of intelligence and will. But note, in Aquinas' account, the appeal to understanding human mind is raised analogically, right, to understand the divine mind, to understand divine providence, to understand Trinitarian processions. I mean, he in other words, it's woven, right, this understanding of mind is just like woven throughout the whole of his account. Would it be possible, is there such a thing as a post-liberal Thomism, or any kind of Thomism that could jettison, right, these, just like ideas of mind. I didn't get to mention Wolfhart Pannenberg, but I just want to tell this story. I was with him at a conference, and I can, you know, he's a Scotist at roots. And I can remember someone talking about God as nous. And he took his head, he just slapped the table. And he said, I won't do his German accent, but God is not mind, God is divind. God is wind. So he was prepared to not, he would just throw that out. Is that possible? So that's my, where I'm coming from,
okay,
and in my thoughts.
Yeah, okay.
Jim, just briefly in response to your question, I feel compelled, since other people told DeNoia stories. I have to tell the story of the first time I met Joe DeNoia, which he probably doesn't even remember. I had, of course, heard of Joe DeNoia because he was a Catholic post-liberal, and we were pretty thin on the ground at that point, right? But before all you good people converted, right? I converted back in 1982 when I was an undergraduate in college, and before I ever even heard of post-liberalism. But I was a newly minted Duke PhD, and I was invited to a conference on somebody I had never heard of before, this guy named Luigi Gisani. I had no idea, I still to this day have no idea why I got invited to this conference. And I read Jassani, the book we're going to be discussing. I was like, my God, this is Schleiermacher, right? It's all about experience. And so I very, very naively thought that I was supposed to be at this conference because we're all going to get together and trash Jassani. I had no idea what it meant that the conference was sponsored by Communion and Liberation, right? So I go to this conference, and I'm raising all these questions about religious experience and Jassani as an experiential expressivist. And, the knives came out. And I felt, in a certain amount of intellectual peril. And Father Dunoya, who had never met me before, sprang to my defense, saying, "Well, Dr. Bauerschmidt has clearly read Schleiermacher, and maybe he recognizes some issues that people who haven't read Schleiermacher might not recognize." I think he actually maybe saved my life. Those CNL people are very at risk. Yeah, and great personal risk.
They came after me.
But what I want to say in response to Jim's question is I have the great good fortune to be married to the woman I'm married to, and she's an immigration lawyer, and she keeps me very grounded in the realities of the political life of our nation and the differences it makes who gets elected to which office, and just as it impacts, her clients. In fact, she was at Dulles Airport this morning at 6 a.m. to greet a Syrian client to make sure that he could get through immigration. So she's always a good antidote to me to, in a sense, take politics in a piecemeal way. To not go for the sort of in toto rejection. My friend Mike Baxter, he always likes to say, "Well, that works out fine in practice, but how does it work in theory?" And I think that that's a perpetual tendency, right, to us who are not really that involved in the kind of nitty gritty world of American politics, and a tendency to fall into a kind of an anti-liberalism because we're so dismayed at the intellectual bankruptcy of most, if not all, forms of liberalism. But my wife constantly reminds me that the discourse of human rights, whatever theoretical problems it might have, I've had problems with it since I was an undergraduate and heard Alistair McIntyre speak, right? Whatever intellectual problems it has, it actually has a certain kind of pragmatic leverage and purchase. And that's not something, it's not everything, but it's also not nothing, right? It's not something to be completely dismissed, because it saves lives. It might take lives, too, and that's the other part of it. So
I'm going to make an observation and invite you all to comment on it. I was initially struck by this when Mike was talking about the relatively brief life of the Yale School in the sense in which he used the term as an actual community of scholars from the early 70s, and I think in retrospect, although it wasn't clear at the time, we can mark its end with the sudden death of Hans Frey in September of 1988. That school, in Mike's sense, and Chad's comments really made this a bit poignant for me, that school proved very fruitful in opening up the possibility of dogmatic theology in the Catholic tradition, certainly with a large C, but also with a small C, for a lot of people. But it was sort of an institutional accident. That wasn't really possible at Yale back in the 40s and 50s. In fact, I remember Lindbeck talking about being a young student at Yale in the late 40s, who really had to defend his Lutheran sacramental realism in a sort of somewhat liberal, hyper-reformed atmosphere of Yale at the time. So the Catholic moment at Yale was itself somewhat brief, and I think is now clearly past. And yet it did produce this sort of moment of fruitfulness. seems to me that, a difficulty that theology faces, Catholic theology faces, certainly, theology more broadly considered faces, is simply how to get to a second generation, how to have something like a normal science that can be passed on and developed and enriched. I think there are a whole variety of reasons why in Catholic theology, following the Council, we've had essentially the disappearance of normal science. Whatever the much maligned manuals did, they provided at least an opportunity for normal science in a good sense. We don't have that in the Catholic world now, and I think probably it hasn't been present in the Protestant world for a good long while, but you have these sort of moments of fruitfulness. Do you have any thoughts about, any of you, because I don't know what to say about this, about how to get to the next generation?
Institutions and syllabi and faculty. I mean, I think at the Catholic University of America, this is what we're aiming at. And we're aiming at it in a context in which we have the benefits and blessings of the Dominican House and also the JP2 Institute. We do have a faculty that remembers when Rahner and Lonergan were kings. But we also have a faculty which I think is moving in the direction that we need more universities to move in, which is one which I think develops a strong patristic medieval modern set of discourses around dogmatic topoi. I don't know a lot of places that are doing that. I think you're right. But that's what we need, is we need institutions and syllabi, and we need people who are willing to convey this for their own sake and to train themselves in this, but also to be able to pass it on to the next generation, an attentiveness to dogmatic topoi across the ages.
Yeah, just briefly, I'll think of my own faculty, theology faculty at Providence College. Our folks have been trained at Fribourg, Notre Dame, Boston College, CUA, by a generation of theologians who, you know, did theology, right, in, as I said earlier, in the light of faith. I think what we do as a faculty, as a whole, is we have a development of Western Civ program in addition to our theology courses. And I think we set before the students the primary sources, maybe you called it syllabus, right? And we all believe very deeply that that's the starting point. So we set before the students a set of readings. We have a strong consensus on what those readings are, but it's kind of mysterious on how we have that common sense. I suppose it comes from this common training. So I want to continue to reflect on that. That's my starting point, maybe just to echo what Chad said here.
Yeah, well, I guess I should talk about my own institution. I don't know if Jim knows this, but in our department, we sometimes refer to ourselves as the house that Jim Buckley built. And I feel like Jim has passed on to us some of that emphasis on friendship and conversation. And we do have a set of common practices. You know, we require everybody in the department teaches intro to theology, right? Nobody's allowed to be so specialized that they can't, at an introductory level, talk responsibly about scripture, tradition, and contemporary questions. And we also, every fall, choose a common text that we all agree to teach that it's, for most of us, not a normal part of our syllabus. And we generate conversations around how to teach that text. So we have a set of practices. We also, I would say, on any given day, between 40 and 70% of the department sits down together and has lunch. We have a table in a common space, which most of our offices are arranged around. And I think these sort of material conditions are in some ways kind of accidental, right? But they're crucially important, or maybe I should use the theological term providential, right? But important. But I have a keen awareness of the fragility of what we have in our department. I mean, we are, you know, you read the Psalms, you know, our enemies are all around us. And you don't want to be paranoid because often they're almost never malicious people, right? But, you know, pressures to not be a theology department, to be a religious studies department, or minimally in our hiring not to make an ability and willingness to teach introduction to theology a requirement for hiring. I mean, that's been our real hedge, I think, against becoming a religious or moving in a religious studies direction. And, you know, I think among ourselves we have disputes about whether, for example, we could ever hire a Jewish scholar. Could a Jewish scholar teach our introduction to theology course? I'm one of the people who believes that there's at least a theoretical Jewish scholar who could, but I have colleagues who don't agree with me on that, and that's one of our ongoing discussions, and it's a fruitful discussion. But it's an incredibly fragile thing. These things are always incredibly fragile, and that's sad, but I mean, I'm thinking now about Kelsey on mortality. It's also, there's a goodness to the mortality of these movements, right? God creates them as mortals so that we don't rely on the movement, we rely on God, right? That God will, I mean, I'm going to sound like a Bardian occasionalist. God will raise up new schools of theological thought. And yes, I think Chad's exactly right. We do need to attend to institutions, but we also have to realize that it's ultimately going to be the movement spirit that's going to create these amazing constellations of contingencies that make it possible to do faithful theology.
You're voting the God of
question to the God Father of Langevin. But before I give him the last question, I'm going to permit myself a brief editorial comment, which is that I don't think it's yet time for us to die. I don't think you're going to get out more hard work that easily. And I believe that there's actually quite a good consensus of healthy theological initiative surrounding the recovery of Aquinas going on in the English-speaking sector of the church that needs to be even more communitarian and galvanized, because I think it's a moment where there's less theology in general in Christendom, and there's a tremendous opportunity to give a tremendous impulsion of good direction. So I hope that the people in this room realize that the fact that we don't live always in the same buildings doesn't mean we can't coordinate. I think we're doing it already.
I was wondering, due to part of Michael Root's presentation yesterday, if the professors of the panel would like to speak about which authors could be skipped and which authors should be read, which books should be read. Now, I think, Chad Pecknold, you kind of got at this. I don't know if you want to say that Sheehan or Garrigou or one of these would be the ones that you recommend has to be read. You just mentioned that there has been a development where people have been able to turn to someone like
Sheehan.
What's
the new syllabus, you're asking?
Yes. Mm-hmm. What's the new syllabus and what can be skipped? Well, I'll give an example. Len Auschwitz.
Just two caveats. You must answer this question because it's very interesting, and you are being recorded.
Thanks for the reminder. I sometimes forget that I'm being recorded.
If they're brief, I'll ask the others too.
Go ahead, Fritz.
Do you
go first.
Oh, no, clearly nobody wants to answer this question.
Yeah, but you seem like you were on cue today.
No, I'm just throwing myself into the breach.
Skip Tillich, I hear he's not
reading. Oh, yeah, Skip Tillich. that was the first work of theology I ever read as an undergrad. It was Dynamics of Faith, being ultimately concerned about the ultimate. It was bracing. But So this is the easy answer in this context. Of course, St. Thomas should be read. Augustine should be read. I have a particular fondness for some of the so-called mystical writers. I mean, I think Catherine of Siena should be read, Teresa of Avila. In some ways, maybe it's a sign of what a kind of an odd place I'm in, that this seems like really obvious, right? Maybe less obvious for some people. I mean, I think Rahner should be read. I think Rahner is, you know, a keen intelligence that's at work under the conditions of modernity, maybe too much under the conditions of modernity, but I think Rahner is definitely someone who should be read. Who should be skipped? That's, Tillich. People might not like this, but I actually increasingly think von Balthasar should just be skipped. I think he engenders more confusion, more heat than light. People are feeling particularly cold, they might want to sit down and read some von Balthasar. If somebody said, should I be reading von Balthasar or Rahner, I would definitely tell them to read Rahner, because Rahner is going to challenge their intelligence in a way that I don't think von Balthasar does, just the nature of the discourse. So that'll be my one controversial remark.
My first inclination is to focus on the theologians of the orders, the theologians which accompany each of the historic orders, including the Jesuits, include them. But
you're a man of great charity.
Yeah, they're a very great charity.
They are an order after all.
Yeah, they're a society. first of all, the theologians of the orders, I think, have to be recovered. And that includes the theologians of the orders that have been working in the 20th century, which would include, of course, both Garrigou-Lagrange and Chenu. It would include, of course, Henri de Lubac. Would it include Balthasar? He invents his own order. I think the who do you skip question is almost a privatio question, because it's better, I think, to build up rather than to say who you're going to skip. Who are you going to have the most fruitful debates with? And I think, for example, on impassibility debates, Balthasar is incredibly fruitful to disagree with or agree with, as you're maybe inclined. But so I wouldn't say that Balthasar is worth skipping. He's actually quite fun to disagree with, as is Rahner. Who can you have productive disputes with, I think is a good marker. And who can you bring into the conversation that will actually order you around not the theologian, but the dogmatic topoi? So if the theologians can aid you in, say, the impassibility debate, it's a kind of nice, idea. You're focused around the object of discerning passibility and impassibility in God, and then the theologians which are most conducive to working out certain doctrinal conflicts, it seems right to me to include someone like Balthasar. So maybe an ad hoc basis, a little defense of Balthasar and Rahner alike for similar reasons. But I think the theologians of the orders need to be followed, and of course this is especially important for the 13th century and making sure the 13th century is an integral part if you're going to recover a culture of disputatio, if you're going to recover a sense. I mean, not that we'll all write inaugural sermons and repeat in every respect, but I think recovering the theologians of the orders in our theological pedagogy is crucial.
And I'm just going to add that, and this will probably show me as really a Yale product, but I mean, I think for Catholic theologian, Farhan is somebody who should be on the syllabus, and I think he's not on the syllabus in a lot of places. I mean, I've talked to people at the John Paul II Institute, and they have some vague, they've heard Karl Barth's name, but they're trying to read Balthasar without having read Barth, and I think that's a very strange enterprise. But I also think for Catholics, just to Barth's confrontation with liberalism, I think, is very, very instructive for Catholics. And I think Catholics should probably read Schleiermacher, too, though in a pinch, Rahner will do. But Schleiermacher, like Rahner, is an extraordinarily keen intelligence trying to operate within what he takes to be the constraints of modernity. And so I think the Barth-Schleiermacher dyad is actually quite instructive for Catholic theologians. And it's one that, I mean, at least to my knowledge, except for Father Thomas Joseph, most Catholic theologians don't touch Barth in their courses.
Just one more thing is, I stress the 13th century, but it's very, very clear that we need to recover the Baroque, the commentarial tradition. I mean, there's just so many names that even people like Rahner...
Trent Poplin knows all of them.
Trent Poplin knows all of these names that we just don't even know, who have really deep syllabi, as it were, that we have no contact with, and we need to recover contact with not only the 13th century, but also the later commentarial traditions which follow.
Let me take a shot at this. Well, I won't go into the fathers. I mean, some of them are kind of obvious. I would include names that have not been mentioned. I would include Bonaventure. I would include Bernard. I would include Calvin. I've done this kind of thing in our grad program, tried to develop a syllabus, and we've tested these things, what we sort of like work and all that kind of thing. So Bonaventure, Bernard, and Calvin. And then moving into the 19th century, this would be my proposal. That Schleiermacher, I mean, I've always loved the speeches. I'm a liberal in that way. I just love the way he unfolds that thing and combines the general and the particular. And Schleiermacher and Barth studying those together. Rahner, yes. Balthasar, no. But at the end of the day, this would be my proposal, and here's my obsession. Wolfhart Pannenberg's three-volume systematic theology. You could skip Schleiermacher. You could skip Schleiermacher.
That's how I feel.
Barth. Well, I don't know why. Schleiermacher, Barth, and certainly Rahner. I think Pannenberg has read all of those. He studied with Barth. He's absorbed Schleiermacher. He absorbed Rahner. And I think he has taken all of those traditions to, I think it's a post-liberal level. Now, certainly, right, he's going to stimulate dialogue, but it's an encyclopedia of the fathers, medieval thought. Now, if you don't read them as a post-liberal, then maybe you would think, no, this is not important. But I do. I think the epistemic priority of the risen Christ, that's the way I read his work, but that's my proposal.
Just one more thing, as we're talking...
I was just talking about what books to assign.
I'm just thinking about how... I'm thinking, actually, of Mike Root's comments about heroic theology and the way in which we start to build syllabi off of the great thinkers. And there's some of which we need to do across the tradition, but also to think about building the syllabi around questio, around questions, and that if our students think about the questions that should build up their learning rather than the figures that should build up their learning, they're going to be better off in the long run. I don't know exactly how to capture that yet, but I think there are models for it.
I'm going to finish soon, but
Bruce wants a last statement. Bruce, last statement? I was going to say, just one little point here, which is not really Ronarian. It might be more Gary Gouagrangius than Ronarian, but I think also, just to say something that's obvious, students need to read the Denzinger. I mean, they actually need to know what the Council of Trent teaches. They need to know what Vatican II teaches. They need to know what was taught formally in encyclicals by John Paul II, like Veritas Splendor, which they're holistically ignorant of. Mm-hmm. And they need to see what the boundaries are, outside of which they basically are no longer held accountable to Catholic doctrine. Because part of the issue is, we're in this age of tremendous experimentalism in theology departments, which is now really fundamentally unmoored from the idea of doctrinal accountability. So without becoming, as it were, Denzinger-toting dogmatists. I think without any kind of reference to principles of where the church has enunciated norms, mm-hmm. Theology flounders. And I just think that's something that we all take for granted, but which is,
yeah,
it needs
I was
to be kind of stated.
Granted.
Yeah.
Whole
no, that's absolutely right.
Thank you for allowing me to weigh in on this very briefly. Except for Chad's concluding comments, I was getting rather hot under the collar with all this historicism from the panel. that when it comes to the question of what should be on the syllabus for theology, the issue is just to give a list of all authors. But that isn't, as you all know, that's not going to get you to what's actually needed and what's sorely absent, particularly in post-conciliar Catholic theology, and that's the formation of a theological habitus,
mm-hmm.
the ability to reason theologically. So Chet's very last comments do point in that direction. Remember, I mean, the syllabus, as far as I'm aware, for, say, Thomas Aquinas, when he was teaching theology, was the Bible.
Yes.
And then the questions. Okay. And the whole enterprise was deeply dialogical, deeply Socratic, in a way that would be almost impossible to generate, at least in the short term, in a classroom that we teach. A student just expected to be talked to like you're a figure on a TV screen. But without that dialogical, disputatious character, you're never going to have the formation of a theological habit. And, you know, some of us were fortunate enough to get it in a kind of indirect way through engagement with contemporary theology. But as far as I'm concerned, you can jettison all theology since 1789, maybe excepting Shaven, and
Newman?
Form a theological habitus of perfect brilliance and beauty.
Please help me thank our panel.
Yeah.